Blog Talk Radio.
Policy.
This, I should mention too, is written by
Susan Lindauer, who was a former CIA asset covering Iraq and Libya, and she was also a whistleblower.
In part, that's because of the Patriot Act. A lot of it equates free speech with sedition. It's got a big agenda with seven pounds. I just read that. In this brave new world, free speech under the Bill of Rights effectively has been declared a threat to government controls for maintaining stability. And the Patriot Act has become the premier weapon to attack whistleblowers and dissidents who challenge the comfort of political leaders hiding inconvenient truths from the public. It's all the rage on Capitol Hill as leaders strive to score TV ratings while demagoguing their outstanding leadership performance on everything from national security to environmental policy. But wait, Congress assures us that the Patriot Act only targets foreigners who come to our shores seeking to destroy our way of life through violent criminal acts. Good, law-abiding Americans have nothing to fear. The Patriot Act restricts its power of roving wiretaps and wireless searches to international communications among bad guys. Congress has sworn with hand on heart its only purpose is breaking down terror cells and hunting out lone wolf madmen. That's what they told you, right? And you believe them? You trust the government? Well, that was your first mistake. With regard to the Patriot Act, it's a fatal one. Would the government lie to you? You betcha, and they have. The Patriot Act reaches far beyond terrorism prevention. In my home state of Maryland, state police invoked the Patriot Act to run surveillance on the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, dedicated to wind power, recycling, and protection of the Chesapeake Bay. They infiltrated the D.C. anti-war network, suggesting the group might be front for white supremacists in Amnesty International, claiming to investigate civil rights abuses. Opponents of the death penalty also got targeted in case they got violent. Bottom line, truth tellers who give Americans too much insight on any number of issues are vulnerable to the vast arsenal of judicial weapons typically associated with China or Myanmar. In the Patriot Act, the government has created a powerful tool to hunt out free-thinking on the left or right. It doesn't discriminate. Anyone who opposes government policy is at risk. How do I know all this? Because I was the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act. My arrest defied all expectations about the law. I was no terrorist plotting to explode the Washington Monument. Quite the opposite. I had worked in anti-terrorism for almost a decade, covering Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Egypt, and Malaysia at the United Nations. At the instructions of my CIA handler, I had delivered advance warnings about the 9/11 attack to the private staff of the Attorney General John Ashcroft and the Office of Counterterrorism in August 2001. FBI wiretaps proved that I carried details of a comprehensive peace framework with Iraq up and down the hallowed corridors of Capitol Hill for months before the invasion, arguing that the war was totally unnecessary. I delivered those papers to Democrats and Republicans alike, to my own second cousin, White House Chief of Staff Andy Card, oh God, and the Secretary of State Colin Powell, who lived next door to my CIA handler. Gratis of the Patriot Act, we had the manila envelope and my handwritten notes to Secretary Powell, dated a week before his infamous speech at the United Nations. My papers argued that no weapons of mass destruction would be found inside Iraq and that the peace framework could achieve all U.S. objectives without firing a shot. In short, I was an asset who loudly opposed war with Iraq and made every effort to correct the mistake and assumptions on Capitol Hill. Then I did the unthinkable. I phoned the office of Senator Trent Lott and John McCain requesting to testify before a brand-new Blue Ribbon Commission investigating the pre-war intelligence. Proud and confident of my effort, I had no idea that Congress was planning to blame bad intelligence for the unpopular war. Overnight, I became public enemy number one on Capitol Hill. 30 days later, I awoke to hear the FBI pounding on my door. My nightmare on the Patriot Act lasted 5 years. 4 years after my arrest, the court granted me one morning of evidentiary testimony by two supremely credible witnesses. Park Godfrey verified my 11 warnings under oath. Otherwise, I never got my day in court. If you care about America and the traditions of freedom, whether you're a progressive or a conservative, you should be angry about this law. First come the warrantless searches and FBI tracking surveillance. My work in anti-terrorism gave me no protection. I got my first warrantless search after meeting an undercover FBI agent to discuss my support for free elections in Iraq and my opposition to torture and sexual humiliation of Iraqi detainees. Sorry, guys, body wires don't lie. If truth tellers don't get the message to shut their mouths, the Justice Department ratchets up the pressure. Defendants face secret charges, secret evidence, and secret grand jury testimony. Throughout 5 years of indictment, my attorneys and I never got to read a single FBI interview or grand jury statement. Under the Patriot Act, the whistleblower defendant has no right to know who has accused him or her of what criminal activities or the dates of the alleged offenses or what laws even got broken. Of course, I was able to piece together my activities. I knew that sometime in October 21, an Iraqi diplomat gave me the English translation of a book on depleted uranium, which showed how cancer rates and birth defects had spiked in Iraqi children. And I was quite certain that on October 14, 1999, an Iraqi diplomat asked me how to channel major financial contributions to the presidential campaign of George Bush and Dick Cheney. The Justice Department got the date for me since I reported my conversation immediately to my defense intelligence handler, Paul Hoven.
It's unlikely the grand jury... It's unlikely the grand jury knew that since the Justice Department has the prerogative to keep a grand jury in the dark, in this brave new world, the grand jury can be compelled to consider indictments carrying 10 years or more in prison without the right to review evidence or otherwise determine whether an individual's actions rise to the level of criminal activity at all. That's just the beginning. Once Congress scores an indictment against a political opponent, the Justice Department can force defense attorneys to undergo protracted security clearances while the whistleblower come defendant waits in prison, usually in solitary confinement or the SHU, I don't know what that is, but after the security clearance, prosecutors have an ironclad right to bar attorneys from the communications from the prosecution to the defendant or threat of disbarment, stiff fines, or prison sentences. Scared yet? Once you get to the trial, the situation gets even worse. The Patriot Act declares that the prosecutor has no obligation to show evidence of criminal activity to a jury at all, and the defense can be denied the right to argue or rebuttal to those secret charges because it requires speculation that might mislead the jury or might expose issues that the government considers, well, secret. After all that, a judge can instruct a jury that the prosecution regards the secret evidence as sufficient to merit conviction on the secret charges. The jury can be barred from considering the lack of evidence and weighing whether
to convict.
Thank you. And think I'm exaggerating? You would be wrong. That's what's happened to me, all of it, and one major glitch. All of this presumes the whistleblower is lucky enough to get a trial. I was denied mine, and though I fought vigorously for my rights, instead, citing the Patriot Act, I got thrown in prison on a Texas military base without so much as a hearing and threatened with indefinite detention and forcible drugging to boot.
Americans are not nearly afraid of enough. Neither is Congress. As of this week, members of Congress should be very afraid. Anyone who votes to extend the Patriot Act should expect to pack their bags in 2012. They will be targeted for defeat. Above all, the words freedom and constitution will never appear in their campaigns without suffering extreme public scorn. Never, ever again. Susan Lauder is the author of Extreme Prejudice, the terrifying story of the Patriot Act and cover-ups of 9/11, which reveals
and Iraq,
which reveals details of her CIA team's 9/11 warning and a comprehensive peace option with Iraq.
So we got screwed over again, folks, and they're going to reenact this damn thing. You can get this on the Intel Hub, okay? Check it out. Oh, man. Makes you scared, huh?
Yep.
I'm just going to go up here for just 1 second and see if this does what I think it's going to do. Hang on. I just blocked out. Okay. Crap. Sorry, folks. Hang on just 1 second.
Are you trying to get videos or what?
Yeah, I just screwed me all up. Hang on a second. It's a nightmare. Okay, hang on, folks. I'll be right back in a second here. Just want to make sure I get everything.
Well, let's play one of those videos?
Yeah, maybe I can play a video right now.
I already have it, but
everyone's talking about. Got a little video here, a little audio for you from Press TV, and it's regarding this big to-do about AIPAC down in Washington, and Netanyahu, and all this kind of crap that's happened this week. Well, this is an interesting, very interesting.
And this is from We Are Change Connecticut.
Right, and a very, very interesting thing. U.S. Congress controlled by AIPAC. And hang on a second. I'll play that. Right.
Tempers flared at the prestigious National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
You have gone there as a radical leftist who hates Jews, and in order to... Don't you stick things in my face.
A pro-Israeli advocate knocked a camera out of the hands of Allison Weir, president of the Council for the National Interest Foundation. The group just finished their press conference on what they call unjustifiable U.S. aid to Israel. The two sides met when the press club scheduled a pro-Israeli news conference to follow, held in the same room. The altercation illustrates heightened tensions on differing views regarding America's relationship with Israel. The Council for the National Interest Foundation wants Americans to know how much of their tax dollars are going to Israel.
$3 trillion. That's including a massive amount of direct money to Israel, then a lot of hidden costs. CNIF alleges Israel receives so much aid and special treatment because the U.S. Congress is controlled by AIPAC, America's pro-Israeli lobby. Executive Director Philip Girardi says Israel spends a lot of money on U.S. elections.
There are many Israeli PACs, and they do give a lot of money very selectively to congressmen that they want to support.
The Council for the National Interest Foundation says many members of Congress fear if they don't always side with Israel that they will face retaliation in their own re-election campaigns.
If a congressman crosses the Israel lobby by voting against aid for Israel or voting against some legislation that Israel favors, they very often will find that the next time they're running for office, there will be a candidate put up against them who is very well funded.
Giraldi is a former CIA counterterrorism expert. He questions why America gives aid to Israel when Israel conducts more espionage for profit against the U.S. than any other U.S.-friendly country.
They steal military technology. They steal information that is useful for telecommunications.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Karen Katowski works at the Pentagon and says Israel receives preferential treatment.
We do not question what the Israelis want.
Katowski believes America is beginning to take more interest in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, in large part due to tough economic times. More and more Americans want to know where their hard-earned tax dollars are going and why. Rhonda Pence, Press TV, Washington.
There you go.
So that's where your money's going, folks.
That's exactly where it's going, right down the toilet in Israel. And, that son of a bitch... slapped the camera right out of that woman's hand.
And she didn't say anything. She just
that Israeli bastard. Yeah, unbelievable, unbelievable. And they get away with freaking murder. Anyway, I'm going to go back to the site that I had before. Taboo. And I wanted to read just a couple. There was another article I wanted to bring up tonight on the anthrax. And I'll just be 1 second here so I can find that. And are American children to be used in medical experiments to test anthrax vaccine? Did you want to read that?
Go ahead. The highly controversial and potential lethal anthrax vaccine may be tested on U.S. children if the federal government gets its way. Although adverse event reports related to the vaccine among adult test subjects have included hospitalization, disability, even death, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services exploring the possibility of testing the vaccines on children. That's a group
pretty,
that can't
ridiculous.
Talk back.
Yeah. And Nicole Lurie, the assistant secretary, this is from Natural News, by the way, .com. Nicole Lurie, the assistant secretary for preparedness and response of the DHHS, recently requested that the National Biodefense Science Board submit an evaluation of safety issues relating to testing the anthrax vaccine on children. The DHHS, I don't know what the Department
of Health,
and Human Services. Thank you.
Yeah.
Frames the possible testing as an issue of biodefense preparedness. However, the possibility of pediatric testing of the vaccine ignores the vaccine's danger and raises the specter of class. class and or race-based selection of medical test subjects, which has haunted U.S. health agencies for over a century. Even in the months of 2001, when letters containing anthrax were mailed to several congressional leaders, heightening national fears during the post-9/11 period, Bill Frist, the physician and then Senate Majority Leader, urged caution to use of the anthrax vaccine. He told CNN, "There are very real and potential side effects from the serious side effects on the vaccine, and anyone who elects to receive the vaccine needs to be made aware of that. I do not recommend widespread inoculation. There are too many side effects, and if there is limited chance of exposure, the side effects would far outweigh any potential advantage." And he knew that because they used that on soldiers going into Iraq.
That's right.
And right.
A lot of side effects.
And there were a tremendous number of side effects, including blood clots and insanity. Okay, they actually had 25% of the cases had developmental problems. Okay, the people that took that vaccine. A 2007 report by the CDC, along with the vaccine healthcare centers of the Departments of Defense and the watchdog group Government Accountability, estimated that between 1% and 2% of vaccinated military personnel experience severe adverse effects which could result in disability or death. That's what I was saying. If a vaccine with its kind of reputation is to be tested on children, one has to wonder which children. It is fairly certain those young test subjects won't be the offspring of high-ranking government officials or corporate vice presidents and CEOs. The history of the medical testing carries a taint of racism, classism, and opportunism. As health officials select those with less education and fewer choices to be unwitting guinea pigs in medical experiments, supposedly in the name of scientific advancement. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist or history professor to have heard of the notorious 40-year-long Tuskegee experiments in which the U.S. Public Health Service withheld syphilis treatment from infected black men to measure the effects of the disease.
In October of 2010, President Obama apologized to Guatemala for tests during the 1940s when the U.S. Public Health Service used prostitutes to deliberately infect deliberately infects 700 prisoners, soldiers, and patients with emotional and mental problems with syphilis, both through visits with prostitutes and pouring bacteria for the disease onto skin abrasions on the subject's bodies.
My God.
Vaccine testing has its own special place in the annals of this kind of integrity-free medical research. In the early 1960s, mentally disabled children at a residential school in New York were deliberately infected with hepatitis so that they could be test subjects for the disease. In 1978, CDC tests for hepatitis B vaccine, which sought promiscuous homosexual male volunteers, has some interesting connections to both the HIV and the previously rare opportunistic diseases associated with the AIDS virus. As recently as 1990, the CDC and Kaiser Pharmaceuticals gave 1,500 black and Hispanic 6-month-old infants an unlicensed measles vaccine without the approval and consent of their parents. For more details of these stories and other true life medical experimentation horrors, you can go to naturalnews.com.
/02233HTML.
Nobody's going to remember that. Just go to Natural News and you can find those articles.
Naturalnews.com, great site. And, let's see, here we go. You know what did I just do?
This isn't what we want, Leo.
No.
This is statistics.
No. Again. Yes, I.
Just go back.
So it's like, you know, as far as Bugs Bunny,
I just had
you might
to correct,
as well have voted for Cynthia McKinney.
Well, it wasn't about who I voted for. It was correcting what they said in that article.
Yeah. There's one more article before I start the video, the audio portions tonight. This one kind of blew me away when I read it. Did you read this one? I read last week, TSA, the security group, backs down from prom night grope. Last week, it was announced that TSA goons would conduct a grope down of students during prom night at a Santa Fe high school.
Gee, were they hiring Arnold as the security?
Probably, yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger as the security guy? He's had a lot of experience with groping.
The TSA promised to move from airports into the New Mexico high school after two girls said security personnel groped them with a federal judge.
And a federal judge.
Ruled the TSA should conduct pat-downs at dances or graduations.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, look at a freaking idiot is on the bench
cool
there.
That is.
Wait a minute. This is coming up here. Hang on.
This is from Prison Planet, Kurt Nemo.
The judge's ruling indicates the federal government and the TSA believe they should be conducting searches. The TSA has moved from airport to train and bus stations. TSA boss Napolitano has said she envisions the agency ultimately groping citizens at malls and hotels.
Oh, how lovely.
In February, we reported that the TSA had announced its intention to expand the VIPR program to include roadside inspections of commercial vehicles, setting up a network of internal checkpoints, rolling out security procedures already active in airports, bus terminals, and subway stations to roads and highways along the United States. Following the purported killing of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, New York Senator Charles Schumer
called for a no-ride list for Amtrak, similar to the no-fly list currently used in nation's airports. Schumer issued his demand after the Pentagon supposedly gleaned information about terrorist attacks from Osama bin Laden's home in Pakistan. The Department of Homeland Security sent an advisory to law enforcement officials around the country stating Al-Qaeda discussed tampering with an unspecified U.S. rail track so the train would fall off the track at a valley or a bridge. On Saturday night, the TSA did not conduct searches at the Santa Fe High School as promised. Government searching students is now a well-established practice in public schools. Santa Fe Superintendent Bobby Gutierrez told Cote News in Albuquerque that instead of TSA goons with blue latex gloves, the court allowed Santa Fe High School to use state police to search students.
Jeez.
The TSA's declaration that it will move its grope-down operation into not only malls and hotels but also high schools is part of the federal effort to acclimate the population to an ever-increasing police state.
I hope students will reject this and resist.
Let's see what they say here.
Tomorrow night, a certified TSA official will be at the Santa Fe High School prom to oversee student searches.
Heather Mills is live in the newsroom with why a federal court ordered the district to make these changes. Heather?
Well, this all comes after two Capitol High School students' sisters filed a lawsuit saying they were groped by a security agent at Capitol High School's prom last month. Today, the court ordered Santa Fe Public Schools and the security company ASI to provide at least one TSA-certified person at the Santa Fe High School prom and the Capitol High School graduation. The restraining order also spells out the specific ways that security can perform searches. It says a pat-down is only to be used if there is reasonable ground and that pat-down should not be used as a first approach for every student. We talked to one of the sisters suing the district earlier this week.
She had grabbed my breast and then grabbed the inner part of my bra and shook it. And then she picked up the front of my dress to, like, mid-thigh, and she was patting down my bare leg.
Capitol's principal told us she was standing right there when the students were searched and doesn't remember any students complaining about the pat-downs. Meanwhile, Santa Fe Public School says it is happy to comply with the federal court's decision, saying student safety is their first priority. Live in the newsroom, Heather Mills, KOB, Eyewitness News 4.
Mm.
So that's that. But I'll tell you something, folks. It's getting bad. And if you allow your kids to get patted down by TSA people when you're in a prom, for crying out loud, or even a cop, it's goddamn sick.
Why are they having this to begin with? They
I don't
didn't
know.
Say why.
They didn't explain it.
What was the antecedent
that brought it on?
That brought it
on.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and you know, it's just like
going to a prom. It's not
they
even
just
worth
said
it.
No, I wouldn't.
I wouldn't go if I was going to be groped.
What a sick son of a bitch. I mean, it's really sick, folks. Just really, really sick. Anyway, there was something else I wanted to bring up here before we go to the video portions, but maybe I'll just go to that.
Yeah, why don't you go to that?
I did want to mention this tonight.
Oh, Pakistan and China to strengthen military ties.
Yeah, I wanted to mention this because I predicted this a while back. I saw it in other, but. Pakistan's delegation told Wynn that, I don't know who Wynn is, that our sovereignty had to be accepted by everyone. Mukhtar said at Beijing's Great Hall of People, "We will not let anybody come into our territory without announcing who they are." Wynn told Galini that no matter what changes might take place in the international landscape, China and Pakistan will remain forever good friends. Good friends, good partners, good brothers.
Wynn must be the Chinese.
That must be the head of the Chinese. Yes. Hang on a second here. Where are we? Here we go.
Pakistan Prime Minister Yousuf Reza Gilani is to meet Chinese President Hu Jintao today in Beijing and sign the country. Amid signs, the countries are boosting already close military ties in the wake of a U.S. raid that killed Osama bin Laden. Pakistani Defense Minister Ahmed Muttah said in May 18th interview in Beijing that his country was in talks to buy FC-20 jets from China and that teams led by Gilani and Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao had discussed boosting production of the jointly produced JF-17 fighter aircraft. The New York Times said China will provide 50 JF-17 fighters immediately for free, citing Pakistan officials it didn't name.
Oh.
Gilani's visit to China comes as Pakistan's relations with the U.S. have come under strain following the raid on the garrison town of Abbottabad earlier this month that killed al-Qaeda chief bin Laden. Abbottabad is 48 kilometers or 30 miles from Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Chinese officials have said anti-terrorist operations should respect national sovereignty. Pakistan's delegation told Wen that a sovereignty had to be accepted by everybody. Mukhtar said at Beijing's Grand Hall of the People, "We will not let anybody come into our territory without announcing who they are." Wen told Gilani that no matter what changes might take place in the international landscape, China and Pakistan will forever remain good neighbors, good friends, good partners, and good brothers.
President Obama has proposed $1.2 billion in aid to Pakistan next year for programs that include counterinsurgency training for its military forces. Five Democratic U.S. senators, including California's Dianne Feinstein, wrote a May 17th letter to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Defense Secretary Robert Gates questioning the need for such assistance, saying they were gravely concerned about the commitment of Pakistan's security establishment to fighting terrorism. Almost half of Chinese arm exports between 2001 and 2010, totaling $3.13 billion, went to Pakistan, according to the Stockholm.
So we're giving them money, they're taking the money and they're buying...
No, they're buying the weapons from China. And China's even giving them weapons. China has had diplomatic ties with Pakistan for six decades, helping the country build power stations, roads, deep water port. Ahead of the visit, Gilani told the official, Xinhua News Agency that China was Pakistan's time-tested and all-weather friend. And Gilani told Xinhua that China was the first country to show support for Pakistan following the raid against bin Laden. And the FC-20 fighter, known as the J-10 in China, is roughly equivalent to the U.S. F-16C fighter, according to the Asian Defense Blog, which tracks Asian military developments. And so that's what's happening there, folks. And
so we've effectively pushed Pakistan into China's
eyes. Yeah, exactly. They're where they've been all along, but nevertheless.
Now they can do it more openly.
Yeah, why not? You know, why not? And this one.
Oh, this
is our first.
Who really owns the mainstream media?
Yeah, this is the first of our audio presentations tonight. This is about 10 minutes long, so we'll get right to that one. It's called "Who Really Owns the Mainstream Media."
It's a sobering fact that the hidden power structure of international finance has exerted tremendous influence over public opinion in this country through its virtual control of higher education and major segments of mass communications. The human mind is like a computer. No matter how efficient it may be, its reliability is only as great as the information fed into it. If it is possible to control the input of the human mind, then no matter how intelligent a person may be, it's entirely possible to program what he will think. And yes, it's even possible to program people to laugh at the mere mention of the word conspiracy.
You shall have a world government, whether you like it or not, by conquest or consent. James Warburg, Council on Foreign Relations.
One of the topics that is taboo is any discussion whatsoever about shadow government. Now, 10 years ago in the early 90s, when people called in mainstream talk shows and brought up issues like the Council on Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission, in some cases there was one major talk show who proudly says he's got half of his brain tied behind his back, actually said on the radio that there was no such thing as the Council on Foreign Relations, and anybody brought that up was a conspiracy wacko, kook, wingnut, et cetera, et cetera. Now we all know, of course, that the Council of Foreign Relations is a very real organization. It's been around for a long, long time.
The year is 1917, and Representative Oscar Calloway enters a disturbing statement into the U.S. congressional record. The statement reveals why J.P. Morgan interests hired 12 high-ranking news managers. The 12 were asked to determine the most influential newspapers in America. They were to figure out how many news organizations it would take to control generally the policy of the daily press of the United States. The 12 found it was only necessary to purchase the control of 25 of the greatest papers. An agreement reached. The policy of the papers was bought, and an editor was placed in each paper to ensure that all published information was in keeping with the new policy. Soon, that policy would be defined by a front group formed by J.P. Morgan and his colleagues. In fact, Morgan's personal attorney was founding president of the organization, the Council on Foreign Relations. CFR maintains that its goal is to increase America's understanding of the world. However, the actual objective of this highly exclusive club is revealed by the rare admissions of the insiders themselves. In the early 60s, a Georgetown University professor collects information for a book favorable to the network of powerful men who founded the CFR. For 2 years, Professor Carol Quigley is allowed to examine the confidential papers and secret records of this network. Quigley reveals that these men aim to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. In short, they seek total and quiet control of the entire world. And the CFR is their most visible conduit for carrying out that agenda. our members include America's wealthiest tycoons, as well as the highly placed elite in government, academic institutions, tax-exempt foundations, and the establishment media. Ruling Class Journalists, written by Richard Harwood, describes the CFR membership as the ruling establishment in the United States. The Washington Post article boasted that news reporters who are CFR members do not merely analyze and interpret foreign policy for the United States, they help make it. Who are these policymakers? Many of their faces are familiar. NBC's Tom Brokaw, CBS's Dan Rather, ABC's Barbara Walters, Jim Lehrer of PBS, William F. Buckley of National Review, media mogul Rupert Murdoch, owner of the giant multifaceted News Corporation. These media heavyweights, and many others like them, are members of the CFR. Powerful corporations are also invited to become members. At the close of the 20th century, CFR influence presided over far-reaching consolidations of media control. In 1995, CFR members Michael Eisner of Disney and ABC's Thomas Murphy merged their media empires. Soon after the merger, the Disney-ABC empire becomes a CFR corporate member. In the year 2000, the world's largest internet service provider, America Online, joins forces with Time Warner, one of the world's largest news organizations. The CEOs favoring the move are CNN's Thomas Johnson and Time Warner's Gerald Levin, both CFR members. Once again, another media giant is created under the shadow of CFR influence. Today, an elite handful of individuals define the agendas that are supported by the empire of establishment news. One of the CFR's strongest media allies is the New York Times. As a major outlet for the establishment viewpoint, the Times has achieved dominant influence over the reporting of national and international news. The Times is relied upon by many editors in the mainstream news media for direction on how to portray world events. In addition, the Times wire service retails the establishment line to subsidiary outlets such as broadcast news distributors and regional newspapers. Competition between these outlets rests primarily on the style of regurgitating the same message.
America forms its opinions by information that's provided to them. And common sense will tell you that if the information that you get from your mainstream media is misinformation or disinformation or even a lie, then common sense will tell you that the opinion is an extension of the lie. Now, unfortunately, America and indeed the rest of the world is getting information that's being massaged, it's being spun, it's being prepared for them for consumption. And when we watch the mainstream media, it's really easy to recognize this after a while because, you know, the mainstream media usually carries three major stories as a continuing ongoing investigation. And, of course, they intersperse other unimportant stories in between. So while America is continually watching stories about Michael Jackson or Scott Peterson or Natalie Holloway, or sometimes they'll get really controversial and they'll talk about some of the scandals in Washington, the Valerie Plame issue. There are all kinds of things happening behind the scenes while America and the rest of the world focuses on these big three news stories that are, of course, you know, paraded in front of America 24/7 and told that this is real news.
And why is that woe to us? Because you people and 62 million other Americans are listening to me right now. Because less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel, the ultimate revelation. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. This tube is the most awesome goddamn force in the whole godless world. And woe is us if it ever falls into the hands of the wrong people. And when the 12th largest company in the world controls the most awesome goddamn propaganda force in the whole godless world, who knows what shit will be a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. But man, you're never going to get any truth from us. We'll tell you anything you want to hear. We lie like hell. We'll tell you that Kojak always gets the killer and that nobody ever gets cancer in Archie Bunker's house. And no matter how much trouble the hero is in, don't worry, just look at your watch. At the end of the hour, he's going to win. We'll tell you any shit you want to hear. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds. We're all you know. You're beginning to believe the illusions we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and that your own lives are unreal. You do whatever the tube tells you. You dress like the tube. You eat like the tube. You raise your children like the tube. You even think like the tube. This is mass madness, you maniacs. In God's name, you people are the real thing. We are the illusion. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of the sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off.
That last scene was from Network, the movie Network. And
he makes a good point.
Yeah. We were talking there during that, and what I wanted to bring out was
they had a list of CFR members.
Yeah, I'm just going to go back just quickly. Maybe we can read some of these to go. Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, CBS News, everybody, Bill Moyers. Okay,
this is an older list,
but Katie Couric is on there as well. I know she's a member. Brian Williams and all these jokers. This is an older video, but let's see, ABC, everybody, Barbara Walters, of course, and Ted Koppel,
PBS,
let's see.
The Hartford, in Hartford, Connecticut is part of it.
In the whole godless world, who knows what shit will be peddled for truth on this network?
Wait, is that Hartford Gun? Hartford Current, I think. PBS. No, Hartford, Connecticut, I guess.
Hartford, Connecticut.
I guess. Again, it's hard to read this, but there's CFR. PBS. McNeil, LaHare.
William Buckley.
Jim LaHare. Yeah, but McNeil is still there. Or Jim LaHare is still talking. David Shore. He died a few years ago. But he was CFR, and he was supposed to be the Village Voice guy, you know. He was supposed to be the big, tough guy. He was a CFR member. Of course, William Buckley was a big shit. Let's see, a couple other names we recognize here. But Captain Graham, who was the... UPI... Press International,
Reuters,
Boston Globe, Baltimore Sun, New York Times, let's see, who else is there? There's a whole lot of people in the New York Times, probably the entire staff. Let's see.
And don't think if they're not there anymore that they didn't just replace them.
Yeah, Time, Time Magazine, of course, Newsweek, Washington Post. Dow Jones, Wall Street Journal, National Review, Washington Times, Chicago Sun-Times, L.A. Times, Houston Post, Minneapolis Star Tribune, Louisville Courier, Business Week, U.S. News and World Report, Saturday Review, Reader's Digest, Atlantic Monthly, The Calls, Forbes, Look.
Some of those magazines are around anymore.
CFR, Influence Publishers.
Influence Publishers.
Yeah, Macmillan, Random House, Simon & Schuster, McGraw-Hill, Harper Brothers, Harper & Row, Yale University, and Little Brown & Company. And I'm sure they probably added another 100 of those to that list. Those are the major guys. And that's where we are.
What they don't have on there now is, and how they need to update it, they need to update it by talking about bloggers and the Internet.
Yeah, who's associated there? This was,
and that's why they need to do a little
this
work.
This was uploaded in August of 2009. All right, but whether or not that's when it was done, I don't know.
Looks older than that.
But that's bizarre. Anyway, so I just thought you should know about that. Now it's almost nine. I'll see if I got another chance to do this.
We'll be having at the top of the hour ring with Woody.
And then we're going to start the, and then at 9:30 we'll begin the.
We'll have
the harp presentation, which is really quite fascinating. All right. So let's see what else. This we can read this one right now, if you like, before Pete comes on.
Yeah. Yeah, Monsanto.
Yeah, Monsanto.
Out of Whole Foods. Organic Consumers Association, millions against Monsanto, Chicago to Seattle, on to Boulder, New York, in your town. This is from, let's see who wrote this.
This is Organic Consumers Association.
By Alexis Baden Mayer, Esquire, Political Director, Organic Consumers Association.
Right. And they're protesting Whole Foods for having Monsanto products in there. And says, Chicago is great. Oh, well, this is just a statement here, but let's see. On Tuesday, on Sunday we had a productive Millions Against Monsanto activist strategy session with Cassie Green. On Tuesday, a dozen Illinois Millions Against Monsanto activists staged a GMO food dump outside the Lincoln Park Wholesale Food Market in Chicago.
No, again, the Lincoln Park Whole Food Market.
Whole Foods Market in Chicago to press the store to stop selling unlabeled GMO food. We brought banners, signs, leaflets, and petitions. We wore white coveralls and face masks. We carried a large trash can with a big biohazard symbol on it and a shopping bag full of non-perishable packaged foods purchased at Whole Foods that we suspected contained GMO ingredients. And planned to return to the store. We tried to get close to the store's entrance, but respected a request from employees to move from a store's property to the public sidewalk. We moved away and started setting up on a sidewalk near the driveway leading into the parking lot. Two activists started dumping the GMO food into our biohazard disposal facility. Our local organizer, Mike Dershman, was holding a banner behind them, and I walked across the driveway seeing how the tableau looked for the perspective of the TV cameras and photographers. I didn't notice the cops until I saw one reach for his handcuffs and grab Mike from behind. I rushed over saying, "We don't want to get anyone arrested," thinking I could negotiate an acceptable location for the demonstration. But before I could say another word, the cuffs were on us both, and Mike and I were dragged off to jail.
Thanks to the rest of our action team who kept the demonstration going after we were gone, they continued with the food dump, passed out lots of Monsanto out of Whole Foods leaflets, and got Whole Foods customers to sign our petition for mandatory GMO labels, and a special thanks to many of you who gave us the support and good wishes while we were being held in jail. So it's about standing up for what you want, standing up.
The Whole Food Market claims that they didn't call the cops after they stopped claiming we hadn't been arrested at all. That they aren't seeking prosecution. We ordered to ask to answer the charges to disorderly conduct on June 7th, all right, and agree that our demand for mandatory GMO labels and that they are trying to increase the availability of organic and non-organic and non-GMO foods.
If that's true, this is what they need to do. respect their customers' rights to know about GMO by labeling all genetically modified foods sold in Whole Food markets. Give up the idea that organic can coexist with Monsanto's genetically engineered crops. Until Whole Food markets, companies that use organic ingredients and have grown with consumers fully boycott Monsanto, we are aiding and abetting the genetic contamination of organic. And until Whole Food markets puts genetically modified ingredients on their list of unacceptable ingredients, they are totally endorsing Monsanto's products and allowing consumers to wrongly believe that GMOs are safe, natural, and environmentally sustainable. Stand up for freedom of speech. As I begin organizing next week's protest at Trader Joe's in Seattle, I see the chilling effect that my arrest has had on activists willing to exercise their freedom of speech and stand up to companies that sell unlabeled, genetically modified foods. Already, several millions against Monsanto activists in Seattle have backed out of our Tuesday action with fears they might get arrested. If Whole Food agrees that Mike and I were long molested and the public sidewalks of this nation should be open to peaceful demonstration against GMO, their employees and executives should contact the Chicago Prosecutor Office, drop the disorderly conduct charges against Alexis Baden Mayer and Mike Derschmidt, and revoke the order for them to appear on these charges on June 7th, 2011.
Same thing happened to our friend Ned Cole. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was kicked out of the Hartford Current off the sidewalk and arrested for protesting their bias and the Hartford Current in Connecticut.
Well, right now we have our regular guest, and we'll put
sports
on his
reporter Woody.
And we'll put on his music.
Your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics: Armstrong, why so strong? NBA playoffs. Wilpon speaks loudly and carries a small stick. And of course, some baseball. Let's get right down to it with a little bit of Lance Armstrong news. Now, Russian cyclist Vyacheslav Ekimov stands to receive his third Olympic gold medal in the wake of Tyler Hamilton's doping admission. A former teammate of Hamilton's with the U.S. Postal Squad, Ekimov is irritated by Hamilton's allegations on 60 Minutes that Lance Armstrong and other team leaders encouraged, promoted, and took part in a doping program on the way to winning the Tour de France a record 7 times. Ekimov still works with Armstrong and team director Johan Brunil as a manager with the Radio Shack team. He said the reaction within the squad has been one of total disappointment of people that you used to work with, and then all of a sudden you see their real faces. Yeah, I'm sure they're real disappointed that one of their former teammates has come forward to say they were all doping. I mean, you know, I'd be shocked too. Meanwhile, the International Cycling Union rejected Hamilton's allegations that it helped cover up a positive drug test by Armstrong at the 2001 Tour de Suisse. The UCI said it was deeply shocked by the allegations and insisted it has never altered or hidden a failed test. In the 60 Minutes interview, Hamilton said Armstrong tested positive for EPO at the Swiss race. The UCI criticized Hamilton for abusing the trust of cycling fans and hinted at pursuing legal action. Now, almost everyone in the free world probably heard the Lance Armstrong story, overcoming testicular cancer, winning the Tour de France, yada, 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 overcoming great odds, so on and so forth. But he did some stuff that was kind of superhuman, and when you're doing superhuman stuff, either you're not human or you're taking performance enhancers. I mean, that's usually the case. To me, it was rather obvious that Armstrong, you know, was getting over on the rules. You know, somehow, you know, he probably did a blood transfusion. You know, he was definitely juicing, but, you know, they weren't able to prove it. And this is eventually what happens to athletes years after either someone has a bad conscience or someone gets arrested with some juice, i.e. steroids or whatever the case may be, and then they want to trade information to, you know, get their head out of the noose. So this is what kind of happens. When people do superhuman stuff, there's usually a reason they're doing superhuman stuff. You know, it's not that they're superhuman. It's that they've been assisted by performance enhancers. So, you know, when Armstrong was doing all this stuff and just doing some incredible stuff, you know, I mean, it, you know, it was great for the sport and everything else, but at the same time, you're kind of like, that really can't be right. Kind of like, you know, when baseball had that little bit of a renaissance there, when dudes were hitting home runs like it was going out of style in 1998. I mean, the home runs were just off the hook, and you're like, wow. A lot of home runs, kind of good for the game, but, like, really? Dudes are hitting home runs like that just naturally? Probably not so much. So this is kind of an interesting story. Maybe it'll take on a little bit of life of its own if it, you know, if it goes any further. You would think that it probably would. So this will probably, you know, bear a little bit of watching. Moving on to a little bit of basketball stuff. Okay, in the Eastern Conference Finals, we have my Chicago Bulls facing the Miami Heat. I picked the Bulls, but, you know, kind of thought the Heat would probably beat them because we don't have enough scoring. Right now the Heat are up 2-1 over the Bulls. And Derrick Rose has been kind of shut down in games 2 and 3. What you have is, you know, Rose scored 28 points in the, you know, Chicago series opening victory, and he had 21 and 20 in the next two games, you know, both Bulls losses, you know. But if you look in the box score, you know, those points look fine, but they're really deceiving. You know, he only scored 2 points on 2 free throws in the fourth quarter of game 2 and 2 points and 1 field goal in the fourth quarter of game 3. You know, and no points in the final 7 minutes, and he's like 1 for 6 in the final 2 quarters of the last 2 games. So that's not really too good, you know. For the Heat, Chris Bosh, I think he's pretty high right now. He's shooting like 67% or something. You know, he's like 13 for 18 and shooting 34 points in game 3. The Bulls are definitely not hot. They're only shooting, I think, less than 38% over the last 2 games, you know, which are both losses. And they're only shooting like 32% in the fourth quarters of game 2 and 3. Now, what they need to do, they need to play some better defense. They cannot let the Heat continue to shoot, you know, 50% or better from the field. The Bulls will definitely have trouble winning, you know, if that, you know, persists. And Rose has to pick up his game a little bit. I mean, the kid's got a lot of heart, but, you know, he's got to, you know, he's got to make it happen in tonight's game. If they, you know, the Bulls need to win tonight, you know, to even up this, you know, even up the series. Otherwise, you're going to have a real problem climbing out of a hole 3-1. Now, who's in a hole of 3-1? Well, Oklahoma City in the Western Conference Finals. Now, last night they had Dallas on the ropes, and they let it slip away. They were going to tie the series at 2-2, but and they were up. But I think youth and inexperience took over, and they kind of choked. Now, you know, this is the kind of thing that will either destroy a team or make them a little bit stronger. They had a lot of turnovers. Almost looks like their guards, you know, may not be a good match, but we'll have to see. I mean, Durant's a great player. But, you know, we'll have to see. I'm pretty sure Dallas is going to close this one out. I picked Dallas. But Oklahoma City, man, maybe they'll come back and win another game. We'll see. They're certainly going to have to if this series is going to, you know, go on any longer. Now, speaking of going on any longer, Fred Wilpon gave an interview to the New Yorker magazine concerning his Mets team. Now, Wilpon, as many know, has been in a lot of trouble. He was involved in that Ponzi scheme with Bernie Madoff. I'm not saying he was involved on the Bernie Madoff side. I'm saying, you know, he did make some money, and he was unaware of the actual Ponzi scheme, allegedly. Right now, he's on the financial ropes, and so are the Mets. And he's trying to sell a minority stake in the team, looking to sell 49%. Now, for someone that's looking to sell 49% of the team, it boggles the mind why he would give, you know, talk the kind of stuff that he did. Now, I'm going to run down a few of the exact quotes that he gave, and these were printed. He called his team a shitty team. He did call Ike Davis a good hitter. And let's see, after he watched the Astros game, he said, lousy clubs, that's what happens. You know, that's when the Mets, you know, they blew their chance to win the game. Now, on Jose Reyes, he said the guy's a racehorse. He thinks he's going to get Carl Crawford money. He's had everything wrong with him. He's not going to get it. That's Jose Reyes, the shortstop. He's referring to the 7-year, $142 million deal Crawford got with the Red Sox. Said Reyes, you know, he's going to get that. On third baseman David Wright, he said he's a really good kid, a very good player, but not a superstar. On Carlos Beltran, now this is where he's referring to himself. We had some schmuck in New York who paid him based on that one series. He's 65 to 70% of what he was. He's referring to the 7-year, $119 million deal Beltran got off his breakout 2004 playoffs with the Astros. Wilpon also mocked Beltran for taking the final called strike in Game 7, 2006 NLCS. So, why would he talk this kind of junk? I just don't understand it. Beltran is trade bait come of July. Reyes probably is too. I mean, they're looking to have a fire sale. I assume they're going to keep David Wright, but I just don't understand why you would say this kind of stuff. Now, granted, everything that he said was absolutely positively true. I mean, all of that is true. Reyes has had tons of things wrong with him. He's a guy whose game is based on speed, but he's always banged up. I mean, he's having a great year this year, but why is that? Contract year. Right, you know, he's tried to carry the team on his back, and so he's not really, and he hasn't really played like a superstar. He's been a very good player, and that's also very true. You know, I don't understand why you would say this kind of stuff when you're trying to get someone to buy a minority stake in the team. It just makes absolutely, positively no sense to me. I just don't understand it. So that's some very strange stuff. The Mets called a team meeting tonight, I guess prior to the game, to, you know, kind of talk about, you know, Wilpon's comments. David Wright, who I believe is out in California getting his back looked at, he was kind of nice when he said, I think he kind of brushed it off. Gosh, like, I don't remember what he said. I think he said, referring to Fred, that he was having a tough time and that he wasn't really going to comment on this stuff, you know. But just some really weird stuff, you know. George Steinbrenner, who who's passed away this year, obviously, but, you know, who owns the New York Yankees, you know, there wasn't a time that he can go by when he wasn't, like, berating a player or bringing a player down. But a lot of times he did that to motivate a player or whatever, or make things better. But you can get away with that kind of stuff when you have a winning organization, when you do stuff the right way. And when you have a losing organization and you're snake bitten by injuries and just, God, everything, just like the sky is always falling for the Mets, you can't talk this kind of shit and get away with it. It's just not happening. And, you know, if he trades away the team and they cut payroll in half or something like that, if they're crying about losing money this year, they're going to lose a lot of money next year. Okay, moving on. I had the luck this weekend to make it to the Subway Series. So I went and saw my beloved Yankees play. You find out a lot of stuff when you're sitting in the stadium amongst other fans, you know, because you always see yourself, well, I feel this way or I feel that way, and you kind of turn to the guy next to you and you're like, hey, you know, what do you think about so on and so forth? Now, kind of what I'm hearing is a lot of the same way I'm feeling. Many people are absolutely sick to death of Jorge Posada, the way he's acting and the way he's playing. So, you know, a lot of people could care less whether he comes back or not after the All-Star break. A lot of people kind of cringe now when Derek Jeter comes up in a big situation. It's just, you know, he had a big hit on Sunday, granted, but, I mean, we were all standing up and cheering for him and stuff, but it was like, oh, God, you really don't want to even look. And, yeah, you know, he got the hit, and I was happy he got the hit, but it was just like, oh, God, you're not expecting him to get the hit anymore, you know? It's kind of sad. And another thing, as I'm sitting there in the stadium and I'm looking up, and they always, you know, they got the whole, you know, you got the lineup, and they got all these guys' averages. There is not one guy who is hitting 300. Not one. Now, I remember Yankee teams in the past where there was like five guys hitting 300. And if you look at the batting averages as of today, like A-Rod was 284, Cano 273, Nunez 273, Martin 271, Jeter 268, Gardner 267, but improving. Granderson 263, a lot of home runs and some good stuff. Teixeira, unacceptable 248. Swisher, absolutely unacceptable 214. Swisher is stealing money this year. He has been absolutely horrendous. Tonight, I believe he popped out and struck out, looks totally lost at the plate. And let me tell you something. If anybody should be going at the All-Star break, they need to replace him. I love Swisher, and he's been great. Guys hit a lot of home runs for us, and he's awesome in the clubhouse and everything else. But, yeah, dude, you are not untouchable over in right field. You can go. You know, we'll bring up somebody, we'll trade for another bat or something. I am not taking 214 and one or two home runs on the year from my right fielder at Yankee Stadium. Absolutely not. You're stealing money. What else? Also, something that my friend noticed while I was sitting there watching the game, he mentioned to me that, you know, my excitement was rather lackluster when watching the game. I kind of noticed that myself. For me this year, it seems like when I watch these games, I'm far more tentative because just the way they're playing and stuff, it just doesn't really get you too excited. With these low batting averages, it's a real drag on the production. And you just watch games, and you think if they fall behind just by a run or two, you know, the game is over. The pitching has been fantastic, you know. I, for one, you know, at the beginning of the year, said the pitching was going to be better than people expected. I'm glad that I predicted that, but I also said the bats were going to be incredible this year. So I give it with one hand and take it with the other. Anyway, that's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, and anyone else that cares. Let's get some sunshine going. Until next week, adios.
Thank you, Woody. Presentation on sports,
yeah.
And he's feeling a little upset with the Yankees, I think. They better get out there and get those sticks going.
Yeah.
He's not happy. That's not like him.
Well, we appreciate that, Woody, and we are going to go for a quick little music break, I believe, and then I've got an incredible article I want to bring up to you. It's called The U.S. Education Based on Soldier Obedience Training.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
This is going to knock you out when you hear this one.
But first, let's go to...
Yeah. What do you want to do? A little blues?
All you can eat.
You want all you can eat?
Yeah.
Okay. played by Lila.
Yeah, right. I wish it was played by me.
She was keyboarding that.
I wish I could play.
She was air piano.
Air piano. I can't play for real, but it was fun to pretend.
Air guitar and air piano we do.
Before we bring on our presentation of...
The harp presentation.
The harp presentation.
We got a three-segment, actually. It's really fascinating videos. And I suggest you refer to the YouTube area when you can see them. But the audio is excellent on them. But they talk about the inception of harp and the ongoing problem with harp and how it's set up and the craziness and the weirdness of the people that work.
This will give you folks and of course myself as well. That's why these are important, and Leo and myself, a better background when John talks to us. Our regular guest, John, is unable to be with us tonight because he has a conflict. But Leo prepared these audios for you so that you get a better understanding of the HARP program, and I think I could use a better understanding,
too. I think
too.
It's important to understand where it is, why it's there, who put it there, and what it's doing. And it is causing the havoc that we have today, you know, with all these weather patterns, and it's deliberate, and it's weather as a weapon, okay? And it's been around for some time.
But before we get to that, there was just one thing that we wanted to share with you, and this is...
This next article we wanted to bring up, it's really disturbing when you think about how we've been brainwashed so badly. But this article is entitled
U.S. Education Based on Soldier Obedience Training.
It's bizarre.
It may be hard to believe
that
the roots of our modern education was in addressing the problem of soldiers thinking for themselves on the battlefield, but this seems to be the case. About 10 years ago, I listened to a fascinating interview with John Gatto, in which he described the circumstances that led up to the Prussian model of education. The Prussian army had lost a major battle to Napoleon, and the generals were called on the carpet to answer to the Prussian aristocracy. The generals blamed their defeat on the soldiers thinking for themselves on the battlefield. The solution proposed was to have the behavioral scientists and the military scientists get together and revise the education system to create a more obedient soldier. Read more, U.S. Education Based on Soldier Obedience Training.
Right. Now, let's see. Gatto also states the state was posited
as the true parent of children, which equates to an agenda of breaking down the family and the moral structure of the U.S.
Okay. It may be hard to believe that we read that part.
About 10 years ago, we listened to that. The Prussian army, the solution proposed, they came up with the idea that moving the youth between cubicles every hour, separated by bells, and the rewarding of students to memorize and regurgitate fragmented, isolated information, that's testing, would solve the problem. One author writes, John Gatto, 1991, New York Teacher of the Year and Voice for Educational Reform, has done a solid job of describing how the Prussian model set the standard for educational systems right up to the present. The whole system was built on the premise that isolation from first-hand information and fragmentation of the abstract information presented by teachers would result in obedient and subordinate graduates properly respectful of arbitrary orders, he writes. He says that the American educationists imported three major ideas from Prussia. The first was the purpose of state schooling was not intellectual training, but the conditioning of children to obedience, subordination, and collective life, thus memorization outranking thinking.
Second whole ideas were broken into fragmented subjects, and school days were divided into fixed periods, so that self-motivation to learn would be muted by ceaseless interruptions. Third, the state was posited as the true parent of children. All of this was done in the name of scientific approach to education. The effectiveness of the modern education system is reflected in something USMC Major General Smedley Butler wrote after leaving the military. My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed the orders of the higher-ups. This is typical with everyone in the military. General Butler writes, I would go to war again as I have done to protect some lousy investment of the bankers. There are only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes and the other is the Bill of Rights. War for any other reason is simply a racket. And the statement, that statement by General Clark, that's a different thing. This modus operandi is also reflected in the statements from TPTB.
That's the powers that be,
yeah, and the way they view the military. In their book, The Final Days, Robert Woodward and Carl Bernstein quote Henry Kissinger pointedly remarking in the presence of former general and then Nixon's chief of staff, Alexander Haig, that military men were dumb, stupid animals who were used as pawns for foreign policy.
Gatto also states the state was poisoned as the true parent of children, which equates to an agenda of breaking down the family and moral structure of the U.S. A few thoughts from our leading educators on creating the international child of the future. There is no God and no soul, hence there are no needs for the props of the traditional religion. With dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed natural law or permanent absolutes. John Dewey, the father of the American progressive education, the leading educator from 1924 to 1974, signer of the Humanist Manifesto in 1933, and teacher of the Rockefeller brothers, of whom is claimed by a major pool of educators, no individual has influenced the thinking of American educators more. Every child entering school at the age of 5 is mentally ill because he comes to school with certain allegiances to our founding fathers, toward elected officials, toward his parents, toward a belief in a supernatural being, and toward the sovereignty of this nation as a separate entity. It's up to you as teachers to make all these sick children well by creating the international child of the future.
Chester M. Pierce, M.D., professor of education and psychiatry at Harvard University, speaking to educators at UNESCO meeting held in Denver in 1973, called the Childhood International Education Seminar, none dare call it education, by John Stormer. Every child in America comes to school insane, okay, at the age of 6 because of the American family structure. That was by Ashley Montague, influential educator in the 1970s.
Parents and the general public must be reached also. Otherwise, youth enrolled in a globally oriented programs may find themselves in conflict with values assumed in the home, and then the education system frequently comes under scrutiny and must be pulled back. John Goodland, Schooling for the Global Age, 1981.
My biggest concern is in seeing General Butler's
my mental
faculties remain in suspended animation while I obey the orders of the higher-ups. This is typical with everyone in the military, also reflected in government, and specifically in local emergency response, which has been co-opted by the DHS and also to be a big issue in the months and years to come. With most of the emergency response protocols delegated to government employees via the DHS, we see that the response will be strictly following the guidelines and directives set down by the Department of Homeland Security, which includes FEMA.
After the 9/11 event, the attitude at the Pentagon was said to be cover your ass, with no one wanting to put their jobs in jeopardy by doing anything other than singing from the song sheet. Those that sang for the song sheet were promoted. Those that questioned or became whistleblowers were culled. In my own country, I found it very difficult to generate any interest in local emergency response or defense, as everyone seems resigned to follow orders of higher-ups and hope for the best.
So this is how we got where we are. And it was all planned and organized that we become morons. And, boy, it's worked, because look at the majority of Americans. Holy moly.
Okay.
And the majority of poor kids that are in schools today. So what we are going to do is go to our special report. Business stuff. Pop up. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And going to do that right now. I went back so many times so far. Okay. Right. Here we go. Okay. I'm going to start with... should I start with, did HAARP cause the earthquakes? Maybe I'll start with what HAARP is. That makes
yeah.
more sense. Okay.
But that's
so HAARP 1.
Broadcast weather. Yeah.
The HAARP CBC, this is from the Canadian Broadcast Company. Okay, Broadcast Weather Control, Part 1. And then we'll play Part 2 from that same series. Okay. And here we go. HAARP. This is the CBC. Oh, the program is rated PG. Vancouver, British Columbia. Mr. X.
Jean Manning is a journalist who stumbled into a strange world when she started asking questions about alternative energy sources and heard this.
I meant to say, this broadcast was originally broadcasted in 1996.
Really?
Yes, 1996, by the CBC.
Story of an early 20th century inventor named Nikola Tesla.
Tesla is almost a cult hero and an overlooked genius, and he has so many inventions that are at the basis of technologies that we have today.
She went to a conference on Tesla and had a close encounter with a mysterious scientific researcher who became her deep throat, her Mr. X.
He sent me a file of materials about the Bernard Eastland patent.
About a month ago, the U.S. Patent Office granted a patent to a Houston-based scientist, Dr. Bernard Eastland, for an invention which, Dr. Eastland says, could be used to change the weather. Dr. Eastland says the invention could also be used to disrupt communications all over the world and might be used to destroy or deflect a missile attack.
The Eastland patents had the ring of the mad scientist aspect of Tesla. Tesla talked about this Tesla shield around the planet and talked about particle beam weaponry, something called a death ray.
Death ray? Jean wasn't sure where all this was leading until Mr. X called again.
And he said, the maniacs are actually going to do it up in Alaska.
Mr. X. Maniacs were in the U.S. Pentagon, and he was convinced they were conspiring to build Bernard Eastland's Skyzapper under the guise of a nice little research project deep in the Alaskan bush called HAARP.
The basic concept is to build a very large antenna, then to utilize a large amount of power and to beam those radio waves up into the upper atmosphere.
Have you approached the Pentagon with this invention?
Yes. And what I'm not at liberty to tell you is the details of what that interaction has been.
The word spread through the Alaskan bush, and soon a band of suspicious Alaskans set out to warn people about what they saw as the U.S. military's secret agenda.
Is sort of the universal hammer for geophysical warfare.
Nick Begich is the chief conspiracy theorist.
So when did you know that you were onto something?
I think as soon as I saw the references to Tesla's work and when I read Bernard Eastland's original patents, I realized that what we really had here in Alaska was a prototype for a ground-based Star Wars weapon system.
HAARP is a non-classified project run not by Bernard Eastland, but by the U.S. Army and Navy. The official HAARP story is told by one man, John Heckscher.
It consists of several types of transmitting instruments and numerous scientific instruments that study the natural ionosphere and the ionosphere that has been perturbed by the instruments that we are building.
The ionosphere is a sea of electrically charged particles in the upper atmosphere, and the instrument is a powerful radio wave transmitter.
Does it have any military applications?
The site itself is strictly a scientific research site. Perhaps the outcome of some of the science, perhaps some of the results, could be applied in a military to military systems.
Just a little physics project? Jim Roderick isn't buying it. He's been gunning for the real goods on HAARP, and his weapon is the Internet.
The military is incapable of doing pure science. Science is conducted by them for application in weapon systems, for no other reason.
From his shack in the middle of an Alaskan village, Jim and his co-conspirators around the globe have been tapping into databases. They've dredged up hundreds of long-buried scientific reports and even some internal documents from the military. They call it the world's first techno-protest, and they did it all in the military's own baby, the Net.
Plans for HAARP activities correlate with projections of what can be done in the Eastland patents. It's that simple.
So it's not a coincidence.
It's not a coincidence.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, but it's not his patent that we're building. Superficially, yes, they send energy up into the ionosphere, but the Eastland patents require huge, prodigious, in fact, amounts of power, like 100 billion watts.
Remember that number, 100 billion watts. You'll hear it again later.
HAARP requires only 3 million watts.
There is a paper trail leading us back to Eastland.
No, there is not. There is no paper trail that I'm aware of that's leading back to Eastland. Eastland used to be an employee of the company which is building HAARP, but that's pure coincidence.
Is it also a coincidence that the tiny company that owned Eastland's patents was later swallowed up by an enormous military intelligence firm called E-Systems?
$2.1 billion in annual sales, $1.8 billion of that, with a B, was to military intelligence group, CIA, NSA, and others. And of that, $800 million were black projects, so secret that even the United States Congress didn't know what they were.
E-Systems was then swallowed up by Raytheon Corporation. It, too, specializes in super-secret contracts with the Pentagon.
Why would Raytheon be so excited about this? Well, it's a ground-based Star Wars weapon prototype. For them, it represents potentially billions and billions of dollars.
So how would you describe this world of E-Systems and Raytheon and HAARP?
Dark.
Computers from freezing up in between visits from the military scientists.
Well,
do you know? I mean, do you understand what they're doing here when the scientists come in?
You mean when the scientists come in and shoot the beams up? Yeah, they're shooting the beams up, and I think that heats a little small space in the ionosphere, and then you've got guys that are sitting on computers, and you've got people putting up weather poles that measure weather and everything like that. I mean, there's something spooky going on here.
There have been claims made by some scientists that that you could heat up the ionosphere and affect local weather.
If you were to do Eastland patents, I have no doubt that's the case.
Claims are being made that it could disrupt global communications.
Global?
That it could shut down another country's communication system and enhance your own.
Not HAARP. Not HAARP in
as it is
Alaska.
Now.
No.
But you couldn't disable any system?
Those that used, if the system used a path which was accessible to the HAARP beam, yes.
Starting to sound like Eastland's invention to you? Well, remember, John Hechter says HAARP has nowhere near the power levels Eastland talked about.
Okay,
it seems like this entire thing has been a matter of disinformation.
Eric Nashlin understands the military. He spent 15 years in the service as a radio engineer. He knows deception.
It came to our attention that there was a document, a technical memorandum, I think it was 195 or something like that. And reading right in the front of it, they said that, bottom line, although this is here, it does not constitute publication.
It doesn't exist.
It basically doesn't exist. So it was kind of like, wow, here's the document that doesn't exist. We're talking several hundred pages of document that, you know, doesn't exist on a project that is completely unclassified and open to the public.
We've got it through friendly folks in the right spots. But it really lays out, these are notes from a conference that really break down where they were going to use this technology and how this technology was going to be applied.
Remember the 100 billion watts debate? Well, for Nick Begich, this document was pay dirt.
And in the document that we uncovered, the actual desired level of these researchers is 100 billion watts. And there we're talking something closer to the order of what Bernard Eastman envisioned.
Yeah. You must be familiar with Technical Memorandum 195, which talks about a desired level of 100 billion watts.
Which memorandum?
Technical Memorandum 195.
I'm not familiar with that number.
Well, it's about 600 pages, and it's. I mean, you may not acknowledge it because it's not. It hasn't been published, but it exists. I've seen it.
I don't know what Technical Memorandum 195 is, because I haven't seen it. This is a published document. It's not released. And it's the word games that John Heckscher plays and the word games the United States military plays, and it's the word games they continue to play, and those are the things that need to end.
Zap incoming missiles, disrupt global communications, and engineer the weather. And ready? There's one more. Some people believe the technology being tested here could be used for sinister projects involving humans. Radio waves messing around with people's brain waves. And guess what? The military denies this one, too.
The human mind is subject to being affected by radio frequency energy, and that's what this device is.
In other words, you can move the moods of large populations using this kind of technology.
So now we have not just maniacs in the Pentagon, but a bunch of Dr. Strangeloves? Pretty weird stuff. But scientists have been experimenting with radio frequencies on animals' brains for decades. And the military has followed it all very closely, especially once it found out the Russians were onto it.
It was all kept a deep, dark secret by the two superpowers.
Back in the 60s, the Soviets began zapping the American embassy in Moscow with a low-frequency beam. No one knows for sure what they were up to, but one theory is that they were trying to mess with people's central nervous systems. And one report did say the diplomats got depressed a lot. And hey, just think of all the nifty applications against the enemy. Why blow people up when you can drive them crazy?
From documents dating back into the early 80s, we see that the military had discussed the possibilities of mind control through radio frequency energy. The possibility is there. The military has studied it.
A 1982 Air Force report called radio frequency energy a major new research initiative and said that RF can, quote, disrupt normal purposeful behavior. A 1987 military report called for more research on RF energy as a non-lethal weapon, while pointing out that most of the existing technology is classified. And sure enough, in 1993, there was a big conference at Johns Hopkins University. Here, the entire conference was classified. But the agenda wasn't, and weapons using extremely low radio frequencies, or ELF, were listed as a very attractive option.
Is it just a coincidence that there's been all of this talk and that HAARP will be experimenting with this? Is that all just coincidence?
I believe the ability of ELF to affect the mind is a side issue for us. It may be real. I can't say.
It's been exceedingly difficult to find information on what is supposed to be a major new initiative of the military. All we see is HAARP.
That I'm being kept in the dark, if that's the case. The question is, could they, would they? And we believe they can, and we believe they will. Somewhere, at some point, all of this technology merges at some level within the Pentagon. It happens to be in Alaska, and it happens to be now.
It isn't just conspiracy theorists who are concerned about HAARP. In January of 1999, the European Union called the project of global concern and passed a resolution calling for more information on its health and environmental risks. Despite those concerns, officials at HAARP insist the project is nothing more sinister than a radio science research facility.
You're right.
Wow. So anyway,
we'll go on to the next one.
Yeah. No, actually, I have.
Give us a little background.
The next one is. Well, I wanted to bring up HAARP causing the earthquake.
Yeah.
Right. In Japan, and then the one in Haiti. Okay. So, but let's go to the Fukushima earthquake.
Yeah, because that's of great interest to everyone.
Right.
And
massive,
it's just recent.
Massive HAARP activity recorded in the 48-hour period up to and including the Japanese earthquake. I make no claim HAARP is to cause. I'm merely presenting it to you.
Probably the evidence of it.
Right. So here it is. Japanese earthquake, right?
Massive HAARP activity, the 48 hours.
Right. This is only 31 seconds, but it shows a graph which shows this incredible HAARP activity. Right here, it's off the charts. Yeah. So that's so much for that.
I don't know the causes, but there was a lot of HAARP activity. And you can't see that, but there's no audio.
Yeah, the one I wanted was the one that said, here it is. All right, here it is. This is what shows, I think this is the right one. This is on Fukushima. But this states that there was, states how much radiation was in. And if HAARP did cause this, it caused this earthquake to happen, which it can, and we'll go to the Haiti one in a minute, and that explains it a little bit more.
I'm Dr. Nick Begich. I'm an author and lecturer. I have a doctorate in traditional and complementary medicines. I was born and raised and spent most of my life here in Alaska. I also work as the executive director for the Lay Institute on Technologies based in Dallas, Texas. Its main mission is to educate the public on the impacts and repercussions of technology so that we can be prepared in this century. Today that we want to cover is updates on the HAARP story, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, which many people are familiar with. This project initially was a joint effort of the Air Force and Navy to build large radio transmitters here in Alaska. These transmitters would occupy a huge area. Initially, it was 48 antennae in the array. These are antennas that are 72 feet tall, have a cross dipole, so across the top you'll see this type of a shape. These are about 70 feet across. There's 48 in the array. Eventually, at the end of this coming summer of 2005,
we'll be seeing 180 antenna in the array, and eventually the full array will be 360 antenna. The idea between these radio frequency generators is to focus radio frequency energy in a much different way than most of us think about radio frequency energy coming off of an antenna, if we think of it at all. But when you think about it, when you go back to the original companies that started this project, it was a company called Arco Power Technologies, Inc., which was a subsidiary of Atlantic Richfield, one of the largest oil and gas companies at that time operating in Alaska. They sold that subsidiary to E-Systems, which is a military contractor, a large military contractor based in Washington, D.C., who later sold it to Raytheon, who later sold it to British Aerospace, which now controls that technology. But in the course of that, one of the things that they had talked about was what's called Earth-penetrating tomography. This is the idea of sending a signal up into the ionosphere, oscillating that signal off the ionosphere, which actually causes that layer 30 miles above the Earth's surface to begin to vibrate in harmony with the signal on the ground, causing it to act as a giant broadcast antenna, sending that signal back down to the Earth, and it passes through the Earth and see in the form of an ELF, an extremely low frequency signal, a very long wavelength that efficiently passes through the Earth, and that can be used for a number of things, including Earth-penetrating tomography, the idea of looking into the Earth, or in plain language, it would be like, by comparison, X-raying the Earth, or looking into the Earth for underground mineral layers, underground shelters, nuclear facilities, and the like. Brooke's concern was much broader in terms of what could be triggered with Earth-penetrating tomography. And one of the things that he noted was the effect of resonance, this idea of sending energy in, it harmonizes in a way that causes the energy actually to be more than the sum of the total. You know, it's like the old World War I stories where the armies were marching across wooden bridges in Europe, and some hours after they had marched across, the bridges would just collapse. And it was the rhythmic beat of the march across that bridge that set up essentially a vibration that eventually collapsed the entire structure. This idea of resonance, when applied to Earth-penetrating tomography at very high power levels, causes concern for many scientists, including Brooks Agnew, because what he believes is possible is to trigger events within the Earth, geophysical events, earthquake, volcanic eruptions, the kinds of things that may already be on the edge of discharge, and with the right resonant energies added into the system, cause them to overload and actually fracture. In fact, it was William Cohen that actually made the statement regarding weapons of mass destruction and the idea of generating earthquakes artificially. Weapons of mass destruction and the idea of generating earthquakes artificially. Weapons of mass destruction and the idea of generating earthquakes artificially.
The blueprint for HARP, High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program.
What does HARP do? HARP is a large antenna where we beam radio frequency energy up into the upper atmosphere, and we create on a small scale what the sun normally does.
The assignment came that the Navy and the Air Force were to manage the program.
There were some other ideas, both to possibly modify weather.
In 1983, I did radio tomography with 30 watts, looking for oil in the ground. I found 26 oil wells over a 9-state area, and 100% of the time was accurate, which is 30 watts of power beaming straight into solid rock. HARP uses a billion watts beam straight into the ionosphere for experiments. Picture these strings on the piano as layers of the Earth. Each one has its own frequency. What we used to do is beam radio waves into the ground, and it would vibrate any strings that were present in the ground. We might get a sound back like, and we'd say, that's natural gas. We might get a sound back like, and we'd say, that's crude oil. We were able to identify each frequency. We accomplished this with just 30 watts of radio power. If you do this with a billion watts, the vibrations are so violent that the entire piano would shake. In fact, the whole house would shake. In fact, the vibrations could be so severe underground that could even cause an earthquake.
It's being used
earthquake's impact. Unimaginable. Mr. President, I know you've been to Haiti a couple of times already as the UN Special Envoy. Will you be going back?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd be back there tonight. I think I'm doing more good here, staying on the phone trying to help solve problems. We basically need now food, water, shelter, and medical supplies. We identified some places for large numbers of people to seek shelter today. But if anyone wants to help now, not 2 weeks from now, a month from now, we'll need lots of rebuilding help, lots of volunteer help. But now, unless you're in a search and rescue team or a medical team, the best thing you can do is give money for food, water, shelter, and first aid supplies. Those are the things we need. And we set up a website for the UN at clintonfoundation.org/Haiti earthquake. You can text Haiti at 2022. Send a text message. $10 will be forwarded to it. We'll move that money in a hurry. But everybody, this is one of those things where $5 can make a difference.
Then this could become a very different situation indeed. We have seen before the capacity that Haiti has for violence in the 2004 coup, in the 2008 food riots, and it could slip towards that situation again, becoming survival of the fittest.
Don't worry, America will be glad to occupy Haiti and set up military bases there. Oh, stop it. It's for their own good.
The American troops are arriving. They may be needed to keep order on the streets as well as run the operations here at the airport. I believe that we probably have 24 hours in which to get those supplies to the people who so desperately need them. If it slips to 48 hours, I would not want to be the person standing in the back of one of those trucks handing out the food supplies or handing out the water bottles. That could become a very, very dangerous situation indeed. There is no doubt that at this hour we are facing a race against time to help the desperate people of Port-au-Prince.
How kind of the military to come running.
When the fox hears the rabbit scream, he comes a running. But not to help.
So anyway, that's your wonderful HAARP program.
Yeah.
Probably has caused the earthquakes. And, you know, the reason we're saying this is because they want people dead. They want to cause these problems. It causes great havoc around the world, creates great problems, and then the military and the government, the U.S. government, can walk right in
and
take over the government.
And large
countries.
Corporations can go in
and take over and sell things and make all kinds of dough.
And make money.
Rehab everything on American money and whatever. And happy days are here again, you know. So that's that. And it's really staggering, man. It's so staggering.
Do you have some sites where people can go?
Yeah, well, you can go to YouTube. Go to YouTube. Or if you happen to be on Facebook, just go to my profile page. And that's Leo Steele. And you'll see them all post. All these videos are posted on my profile page. Also, what I wanted to do is we just got about a minute left, so I want to say goodnight.
And I do too. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah.
And we'll be here tomorrow night. And Leo will be on Thursday night. We won't be on Friday, but we'll be on the following Friday. But thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Yeah. So thanks, folks.
And thanks, Woody, for being on. And
have a good evening. That's the just let it go.
Oh.
It should go. I think. Barnstormer. Big little Barnstormer.
Yeah, it didn't go.
Hey, good night, folks.
There it is.